Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, CEO of Wisdom Labs, and your host. In this episode, Wisdom Labs' Michael Taff talks with Bill DeWayne. Bill DeWayne works at the intersection of individual resilience and organizational processes and culture, creating ways of working and being that increase effectiveness, innovation, adaptability, and happiness at scale. As a longtime engineering executive, Bill is passionate about providing practical, specific skills and management methods to allow people and organizations to meet the challenges of being a human today. Before becoming Google's Superintendent of Well-Being, Bill ran several groups with the Site Reliability Engineering Organization at Google. He also has 10 years of consulting experience in healthcare, manufacturing, finance, telecom, and media, with studies in neuroscience, team effectiveness, mindfulness, and the latest in well-being science. And now, Bill DeWayne, interviewed by Michael Taft.
Bill, welcome to Wise at Work.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
You are lately of Google?
Lately, as in formerly of Google. Yes, I retired from Google last October.
And how's that been going for you?
Pretty amazing. I can really recommend being in a position where you don't have to set your alarm. Most days, that's really enjoyable.
All your Google interviews include the fact that you wake up with a cappuccino.
That's true.
Is that still the case, or has retirement changed your morning beverage choice?
No, not at all. Not at all. And it's not even retirement, even when I'm on meditation retreat. I'm one of those people who brings their own supply of coffee. Someday, I will have the maturity in my practice to abstain from having a cup of coffee within ideally 30 seconds of becoming conscious.
Nice.
But that time, that's a limitation in my practice. It's an opportunity for growth.
So let's jump right in here. Your website says that you, let me quote this, work at the intersection of individual resilience and organizational effectiveness. So in a way, that sounds like a possible description of our chief topic areas for the entire podcast. So that's fascinating to me. What do you see happening now at the most innovative companies worldwide around this interesting intersection of resilience and organizational effectiveness?
Many times when we first look at mindfulness or even well-being in general, it's really focused at the individual level, right? And that makes sense, right? You can't meditate somebody else, right? So it's really focused on what can the individual do to develop this practice, which then gives you the skills of self-awareness, self-regulation, and connection and understanding. But let me actually reframe the question a little bit and tell you about why this was important to me and then expand it into the organization. So if you had asked me, if you had said, hey, you should really check out meditation, I'd be like, screw off, you hippie. No, I'm an engineer. I'm a scientist. That's not my culture. That's not my jam. And yet, when my circumstances became difficult from being successful, like keep on getting unlikely amounts of responsibility and things to do, it became really difficult.
Difficult in what way?
Mostly around stress management, you know, having this amazing job with amazing people, really feeling like I had the tiger by the tail. And, you know, I developed this really deep expertise in stress management. Unfortunately, my method was, you know, bourbon and cheeseburgers. And to use the language of Google, that didn't scale. And the more responsibility I had and the more sense that I was stretching myself into being of service to the people of the organizations I was leading. Plus, you know, around this time, my dad was also beginning a long process of dying. It was this idea of like, all right, this isn't working. Here I am at this amazing place. And so I went to a tech talk on the neuroscience of emotion from Dr. Philip Golden, then of Stanford, now of UC Davis. And it really opened up my eyes of these practices might be for me. Right? Neuroplasticity and all the science stuff. These practices were presented in a way that culturally matched with me and maybe even gave me a little bit of bravery to try something that, you know, heretofore I'd said that's not for me. So I began this process and got a huge amount of benefit. You know, I've sort of got my legs under me with regard to my own relationship to ambition, not hierarchy or money ambition, but just really wanting to do great things and try things that people haven't done before. And as soon as I got my legs under me, especially considering that I was leading a number of teams at the time, it became clear to me that there was organizational analogs. Like I love coaching. I love helping people get through developmental barriers. And it became clear that you know, these skills that you get from meditation, self-awareness, self-regulation, and connection and understanding, were broadly applicable in the organizational setting. And I'm a huge fan of asking yourself the question, like, what does my community need? And as Google was growing, it outgrew its org chart and bureaucracy. It's a very, very flat organization. And as a result, it had previously required interpersonal relationships to resolve conflict. But now it was actually an organization, through no ill intent or malfeasance, had a slightly different set of goals than another organization. And when they interacted, there was some friction.
What year did you start at Google?
2005. So it was relatively small when I started. And then I left last year, which was just after beginning my 13th year.
So quite a different company at that point.
Quite a different company. And one that requires flexibility and different ways of working. We had prided ourselves on what a flat organization we had. And then you realize, like, literally having 120 people reporting to one manager, people actually started saying, we need management. We need some structure, but we don't want it to be the Dilbert kind.
Initially, you were doing some form of engineering there, correct?
Yeah, I spent my first 8.5 years at Google running site reliability engineering, which is sort of the mixture of how do you engineer these products to be highly resilient. It's very rarely that you notice if Google has an outage. That's very much on purpose. Yet Google is actually having micro outages constantly. So the real question is how do you, and it's funny, there's an analog to mindfulness, is it's not so much creating the perfect environment around you, but it's developing a skillful and flexible response to the calamities that will happen, right?
Yeah, understand the failure modes and prepare for them.
Yep, the slogan of that group is, hope is not a strategy. yeah, it sort of ties into some mindfulness and meditation. So in answering this question of like, how can I be of service? What feels nice to me? I actually fell into this role of arbitrator and de-kerfuffler. You know, when these organizational issues would come up, and actually got trained as a mediator. There's a mindful mediation group called the Center for Understanding and Conflict. And I took their program, and it's very mindfulness-based, pro-conflict. Like, it's better to have the conflict in a productive way than put it under the rug. Yeah. So almost immediately, as my own practice developed, it said, oh, this permits me to be of service to the community. And in many ways, well-being advice ends up being organizational advice. You know, in other words, in the same way that it would be profoundly inappropriate to go to a woman or a person of color and say, you just need to build up more resilience, right? There's clearly an organizational aspect that is an input into the happiness and flourishing. And so it was immediately clear to me that was almost the sort of ethical responsibility, in addition to providing the individuals with resilience, of also taking a look at what are the inputs of the organization. And the good news is that if you're optimizing for the medium and the long term, many times these are the smart play for being effective. The metaphor I use is, like, if you're in a police car, you have lights and sirens, and they're really useful when you need to turn the lights and sirens on. If you're driving around the lights and sirens on all the time, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And in terms of running an organization in crunch mode, it's exactly that. So that's why it was immediately important to me, it just especially in a leadership position. I thought, okay, if I only do this for myself. Mindfulness and meditation in particular.
Yeah.
If I'm only developing these skills for myself and not saying, how can I instantiate these within my community? And this is a key part, starting from how can I be of service? Not, hey, you know, you got to do this. It's freaking amazing. It's just, what are the problems that need solving? And it was just very clear that these skills that mindfulness and meditation brings, the self-awareness, self-regulation, connection and understanding, are this real base skill set that's useful in all sorts of ways. So part of it was wanting to help people solve the problems that they were dealing with. So that's why both are important to me. And I actually have a little bit of negative feeling about well-being programs that only focus on individual resilience, right? Because it just seems to be, one, ineffective because it's missing a whole bunch of inputs. And two is, it's really amazing to work in an environment where, like, maybe even if only 10 or 15% of the people are skilled in those three skills, it really makes a difference. And it's a nice place to work, even when it's crunch time, even when there's conflict that needs to be walked through.
I can see that being the case. We keep noticing that companies are really asking for systemic change, or like change in the DNA is how they often put it, where it's the culture actually needs changing of the company itself to support resilience, well-being, conflict resolution. It's actually something that seems to be cooked into the sauce of the company at a different level than the individual.
Mm.
So how do you see that working, or how are you engaging at these different layers of the system?
So the first layer, and we'll call this maybe the mechanistic layer, is what behavior are you rewarding?
As a company.
As a company, mm-hmm. right? If you are rewarding the diving catch and the heroic Herculean effort that maybe didn't need to happen with better planning, that's a problem. If you are rewarding talented jerks and engaging them by what they get done and maybe not decrementing it for the damage that they cause around them to the functioning of the team. So I think in the mechanistic layers, what behavior are you rewarding? You know, when people go to work, it's generally compensation-based, and people are going to optimize for that. So I think it's really important. And of course, it's not just compensation, even recognizing and holding up as saying, this is something that we value. But I do think who gets promoted, who gets raises, that's a big part of it.
On this podcast, we're rewarding the use of words like Herculean.
It sounds like a Sisyphean task.
Yes. Good job. So that's layer one, this mechanistic layer. What, mm-hmm. what comes next?
Two is leadership, and these aren't in priority order. These are just the orders that I think in different situations, the different ones would be the most important for a particular organization. The second one is leadership modeling. What are the leaders, you know, most organizations, corporations, hierarchical, and the attention is all turned towards a small number of people with a lot of power. And so, of course, there's this idea of wanting to please emulate that person. You know, one of the things that I find hilariously sad about sort of the business advice book world is you can tell clearly when someone bought a book and is trying to emulate someone else's leadership style, even though it's not authentic to them. But people do this. You look at the people at the top and you say, oh, what are they doing? Like if the person is ambitious, they'll say, if I want to head in that direction of being promoted, I'm going to do the behavior that they're modeling. And if they're modeling the sort of bragging about being burnt out, you know, one of the things that we find well-meaning executives doing all the time is sending emails over the weekend. And you can get into this, like they don't mean to. I mean, there is a thing, like you're going to run with the fast horses. If you've made a decision to be amongst the elite in whatever your profession is, you have probably made a decision to spend a lot of time at it, right? And so for people that are going to be executives or vice presidents at these companies, they may have made a choice for a while to just put a lot of time into it. The problem is that in the leadership position, most of them do not expect the people in their organizations to work like they do. Right. Yeah. But if you're sending out emails on a Saturday,
or the 3 a.m. email is coming.
Or the 3 a.m. email, and there's a cultural load to that. So I think in particular, when you see leaders saying, hey, I'm going on vacation and I'm not going to be answering my email, right? You're actually modeling high performance behavior. And so I think the behavior of leaders is really important, and to realize that, you know, as a senior leader, you may have made choices that are right for you that might not be right for people in your organization. And so to model the sustainable high performance, we know from tons of research that shows that the incremental value of additional hours, it flattens out and then becomes negative when you start making mistakes. But when you have these cultural values about always being on and you have a leader implicitly endorsing that, then you end up having the organization put in more hours, but with higher error rates, less strategic thinking. We're not at our best being jerks, damaging relationships when you're stressed out, all those things.
Okay, so there we have the mechanistic layer. We've got this leadership modeling. What else?
The narrative layer. Mm. What are the stories we tell ourselves about who we are?
And so this is on an individual level?
Individual and group. You know, I think the individual is responsible for it. So for instance, at Google, there is this concept of googly behavior, which is sort of this weird combination of kind and smart and hardworking, and also thinking of the greater good. Like if someone does something that makes their life harder to help somebody else, even if it's as simple as like holding a door open for somebody, there's this story that is valued, right? The hard work is valued. The kindness is valued. The thinking beyond your own use case is valued. And it's a common language, and it's quite vague. You know, I think efforts to narrow it down too much would actually be harmful because, yeah. Of course, it evolves, right? And this can really be used, you know, when you look at the issues of race and gender in the tech industry, realizing, oh, we are actually out of alignment with one of our core values of hard work and kindness and collegial respect. you can actually turn to that common understanding, a common narrative about who we are and say, oh, we are not acting in the way that we want to be acting. And then to me, that's a really powerful invitation to shift that's quite different than an HR-sponsored initiative, although I found them to be quite useful. But there's this narrative portion. And, you know, in an organization, what are the legends? What are the stories that get passed down? And are they honored? You know, at HP, this was the HP way. And I think these sorts of stories, so for instance, you know, when you have new hire orientation, are you sharing the values?
I'm curious, what if the stories and legends don't reflect, you know, the narrative culture that you want to move towards or in this idea of reshaping the DNA of the company, rebuilding how it works? How would you build a new one?
Right. So let's start off at the individual level. How can you create these legends if you're in a leadership position? You know, so for instance, something I liked about site reliability engineering is they had the failies, which was the most valuable failure, right? Because as an organization gets bigger and it's in a reputation-based culture, it can be really fear-inducing to go big and fail. Yet going big and fail, especially if you fail intelligently.
Magnificently.
So what does it mean to fail intelligently or magnificently? So some of the criteria for this award were it disproved something that we thought was true. It's very valuable information. Were the bones of it able to be resurrected for something else? There's a lot of times when you go and you build something and it just doesn't work, but then someone can scoop up that code or this idea and apply it in a different area. Or was it just a worthwhile risk, right? If there was a 100x gain, if it went right, but maybe only a 5% chance of it working, depending on the resources and the resources available, that might be a really good risk. And if you say, we tried and it didn't work out, well done. So how can you create these legends yourself in a leadership position? Then if you're in a position of creating the organizational structure, then you can start saying, well, how can I reward this? You know, so for instance, I was just telling you this whole story and it occurs to me that I don't know how much money was attached to the failies. Yeah. There was some money associated with it, but it wasn't like, you know, the OC awards where, you know, you could buy a car or something or, you know.
So the failies were not rewarded financially in a great way. And yet at the same time, it's building this narrative culture that's rewarding what you want rewarded.
Yes. Yes. And there's many different ways you could do that. You know, the best of which is if you're in a leadership position is how can I model this? And then, you know, like the really good stories people talk about. And again, this also goes back to the mechanistic layer of what behavior are you rewarding, right? But for instance, scaling culture is hard. There has to be some mechanism that's different than just individual people getting together over drinks or coffee and telling stories about the old days, although that's also an important part.
It's kind of the ancient human way.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. It's great. This is a way of like, you know, bringing in the new people and telling them the stories of the tribe. And and in some ways now, this is done intentionally in terms of new hire orientation. A lot of these new hire orientations, you know, they try and present this maybe more explicitly about this is who we are and this is our culture. But I think the point at which becomes real is when it comes up in the day-to-day. So for instance, you know, my recollections at Google are don't be evil came up in meetings about all sorts of stuff, right? And of course, we're not talking about like capital evil. It's like, yeah, you know, that just doesn't sit well with me. And this is where I'm coming from. It's at the point when people start bringing it up. So for instance, another one at Google is it's a data-based culture. Right. And if someone says, you know, I hear this, but it doesn't seem like the data supports it that strongly, I'd like to have a conversation around that because this is a core value. Yeah. It's at the point where someone, especially someone regardless of hierarchy, feels comfortable standing on a value in a public or semi-public setting. I mean like public within like a work group and saying, hey, you know what? There's this thing and it's on my mind. I think that's the test of when you know that a culture is successful.
Fascinating. So this narrative layer has a real role to play.
Absolutely. And not only that, but it's beautiful. Like, it's amazing. If you've been in a place with a good culture, it gives you energy. It gives you resilience. It gives you a sense of warm-heartedness. And it also gives you the courage to step up and say, this isn't right when the situation calls for it. So it gives you all of those things, which are all things that are the hallmarks of the places that I've worked or been a consultant in that were the best places to be.
Excellent. So is there a layer four?
No.
So we've got machine and then leadership modeling and then the narrative layer.
Yeah, I think that just about covers it.
So if we can dig in and actually work to make change in these three areas and then include, I presume, individual areas also, would that be sufficient to meaningfully change a corporate culture in the direction that we're looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we've just articulated these are the mechanisms, and if you diddle the mechanisms in the direction that you want to, then yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So I know your background to a certain extent, and I know you're a mindfulness practitioner personally and are very involved in that world. It's kind of interesting because it seems like in corporate America, at least in Silicon Valley here in San Francisco, we've reached phase two of the mindfulness world in corporations where there's some pushback. And there's some discussion about how mindfulness is or is not being misused. To make a caricature out of the well-meaning and I think somewhat well-founded critique, we could say, you know, the evil capitalists are using this sweet Buddhist practice to just drive the workers harder and be more productive. And again, that's a reductive caricature of it. But I'm curious, do you see that really being the case? And if so, how do we mitigate against that, let's say, failure mode? You were talking earlier about understanding how things can go wrong and preparing for that. So how could we, if we're bringing mindfulness type practices into companies, make sure it's not just being used as another way to overwork everyone?
Yeah, I've not had much direct experience with that failure mode of someone saying, let's bring in mindfulness to numb people up. When it does happen, I think it fails pretty quickly. It doesn't work. It doesn't catch on. You know, my friend Sharon Salzberg says that compassion is an emergent quality of concentration. And I think if you're doing these practices, there is some self-awareness and self-regulation that comes of it. And I think if you're being taught these practices to numb you, it has the opposite effect. So I think one of the sort of self-inoculates is that, you know, these practices have someone wake up. Now, one of the failure modes I can think of would be someone doing the teaching who does not have a depth of practice themselves. Maybe they went to a weekend thing and they've declared themselves a mindfulness person. And I think that could be an issue. So I think one of the key issues in terms of protecting against this would be to make sure that there's a common understanding of what is the criteria of a good teacher and are they available to do this. The other inoculation, I think, is teaching values. You know, that we just talked about in the previous session. Essentially, we're talking about values.
Yeah.
And you can look at it defensively and say, like, well, if you don't teach, you know, mindfulness and concentration with values, you can end up with the mindful sniper, which I can't say I've seen. Like I said, I think that there's this emergent property from these.
I agree. I think that the practice itself mitigates against those types of results.
Thank you for putting it much more clearly than I did. Feel free to keep that coming. But at the same time, we talked about the importance of values, right? The importance of values actually towards the quality of working in a place, as well as its effectiveness, as well as its long-term viability, right? So you can look at it the negative and say, in order to protect against this harm, you need to also include values as a portion of this. But to me, this is leaving a big portion of the benefit on the table if you don't also tie this into values. And some of the concrete ways you can do this is, I think, of being volunteering. Like, I think there should be volunteer aspects to mindfulness programs, especially the corporate ones. This is certainly true when I was running the Wellbeing Learning Group at Google, because there's something about reaching out beyond yourself. So, you know, within the context of Google, I worked with kids who are locked up in San Mateo and Alameda, teaching them mindfulness, or rather supporting people in groups that are teaching mindfulness to them, the Mind-Body Awareness Program. And that's a huge part of my practice, right, is going out and doing this volunteer stuff. And of course, it broadens your horizon. It's great for the company because you realize that sometimes these amazing environments are beautiful bubbles. I mean, your appreciation of your bubble is increased, but also the need to transcend it and go beyond it. And as well as, you know, I also work with veterans with PTSD. And, you know, working with these different groups, working with Silicon Valley executives and companies and startups and, you know, kids who are locked up who are mostly brown and black and veterans, very different cultural. Our stories are very different. But what heals the tech executive is self-awareness, self-regulation and connection and understanding. And what heals the kid in jail self-awareness, self-regulation, connection and understanding. The veteran, the same thing. So there's also this beautiful connection that comes from sort of embracing the difference and the diversity. And so when I hear some of these criticisms about corporate mindfulness, it sort of feels like looking at a funhouse mirror. You know, and I need to be careful that it's not as if I've seen every place that mindfulness is being rolled out. And I'm sure there's some shenanigans and charlatans and maybe some of this. But it has the flavor of the bizarre to me. Like sometimes if you're watching a highly politicized news source talking about something you have direct experience about and you're just like, this is a funhouse mirror version of it. I have that same sense of bizarreness. So one of the other criticisms that comes up is that where people's starting point is generally quite transactional. I want to have my stress reduced. I want to have higher performance. And I think when you know what these practices can create, you realize that's just a tiny fraction of it. And yet, my own direct experience, that was my entry point.
That's the onboarding ramp.
The onboarding ramp. It's like, oh man, this hurts. Like this really hurts and I'm not sure if I can take it much longer. I need to do something about this. And I think many times when people come into mindfulness, it's on the heels of grief or pain. And it might even be something positive like, oh, I want to have higher performance or something on the positive side. But I think for most people, when they walk in the door, it's a fairly transactional door.
Yeah.
And this makes perfect sense because how can you know the depths that are available, right? And so to me, a wise teacher meets the student where they are. You know, if someone were to come to me and say, you know, my heart is broken because I'm getting a divorce or I'm having this problem where I'm so sad and I'm drinking more than I should, it seems the height of cruelty to say, well, you really need to realize that your sense of self is an illusion. And until you're ready to step up to that plate, I don't feel it's appropriate to give you skills and tools. So I have faith that if you introduce someone into the path at the surface level, right? If you give them these skills and you give them a path towards depth, you know, I think that's the point at which not only are you not looking down on somebody who's saying, I'm hurting or I want to gain this skill, but rather you're saying, I hear your need. I meet it honorably where you are, and I'm going to give you exactly what you want. I'm going to give you something that can lead to higher performance and more happiness. And there's more in store that you're going to find out, and I'll tell you about it when you're ready, or rather when it's the appropriate time. Again, it's this overall, like the wise teacher meets the student where they are. The best teachers for me are the ones that I felt like that they had a greater depth of practice, but they were also not looking down on me.
Yeah.
And so I think there's all of this, you know, this looking down seems poisonous, saying, well, I'm here in this position and I want you to continue to feel bad and suffer because your quest for healing is not highfalutin enough or is not where I am. Like, it's just, that really doesn't sit with me well. Yeah. And I understand where it comes from because to get people in the door, it can seem a little marketing-y. Like, how do you market this stuff? But to me, the fact that there's so much there beyond it, you know, the sort of trait phrase is yes and instead of disagreeing from the improv world. If someone says something, instead of disagreeing, say yes and. So is having it only be based on stress reduction and high performance sufficient? Yes and. Well, to meet them where they are and to give them this much deeper experience and to make it available.
So what is the most inspiring example of this you've seen in the last year?
So an initiative that I'm really proud of was sponsoring a way to fold in connection and understanding training, right, which is coming out of the work of the Max Planck Institute, Tanya Singer and C-Care and Greater Good from UC Berkeley. And there's all this now research on the training of compassion and empathy. And of course, this aligns with, okay, this is something that the next unfolding of mindfulness in the workplace can really use. It addresses a lot of the issues of concerns. If you're teaching compassion and understanding, you know, the idea of the mindful sniper becomes actually really difficult to achieve. And so really happy with this. And the people that worked on this were my friend and colleague, Ruchika Sikri and Mario Garaletta. And they worked with Search Inside Yourself Leadership Institute to come up with this compassion program. And when she was leading it, Ruchika went around to the lines of business, as we call them, the executives. And, you know, initially we thought, well, what would you like to see in a program dealing with compassion and empathy? But then I had some second thoughts. I have a very vivid memory of like me, Mark Lesser, Norman Fisher, Philippe Golden sitting in a room realizing we all had different definitions of those two things and the way that they interacted. And also going back to the idea that a wise teacher meets the students where they are, connection and understanding is a lot more relevant to the day-to-day people. So she went around to the executives and said, what problems do you have that connection and understanding would solve? And, you know, just huge amount and this real sense of excitement, right? For the salespeople, it was, I want the folks to understand the customers better. For engineers, it's like, we'd like to have disagreements that don't get bitter, right? For administration folks, it's like they would like to be able to understand these foreign cultures, you know, a lot of times, in particular, the engineering culture seems very strange and this idea. And all of a sudden, just it lit up. And there was this idea of, yes, we want connection and understanding, right? And of course, this dovetails also connection and understanding, maybe a different way of articulating compassion and empathy, also key skills about issues of diversity and inclusion and changing behavior. Like if you have the skill sets of self-awareness, self-regulation, and connection and understanding, and you hold the value that you want to treat people kindly and fairly, that's the skill set to change daily behavior. And so, you know, when these classes are instituted, there was a standalone class that has three steps, a quite short class, but also a module that also is then also taught in manager training. I believe it's still taught in manager training. Mm-hmm. So this is a way of, we came to it from our academic deep practice understanding of this is compassion and empathy, but the more skillful language was actually to call it connection and understanding. Mm-hmm. And then in asking people, because if you ask these well-meaning people, like, what do you want from compassion and empathy, you get a completely different set of questions, even though it's the same material. Right. So constantly this idea of how can I be of service? If I use my language, if I use my orientation, to me, it's a limitation on being of service, right? And there's the same idea that the same beauty that I've experienced from understanding what it means to be a veteran, right? What it means to be a person of color, what it means to be incarcerated, like all these different things. This connection and understanding is such a strength-making, right? It allows for a greater awareness of diversity, but also a connection that transcends our differences simultaneously. So it's powerful stuff.
Thanks, Bill.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi, it's Corey, co-founder and CEO of Wisdom Labs. At Wisdom Labs, we're helping companies become wiser workplaces. To create this positive impact in organizations, we cultivate change at the level of the individual, team, and company culture. We see businesses as the biggest lever for positive social change at scale. After all, business still holds the most power and influence in our world, and as individuals, company cultures, and entire stakeholder networks become more wise, we all benefit. To learn more about Wisdom Labs, check out wisdomlabs.com. Thanks for listening.